Wake up.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry Chair Brown is delayed. He should be here shortly, I hope. But in his absence, we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing so some of you can get about other business that you have scheduled. So we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 795. And I understand, do you have a sign-up fee? Is that your bill, Bill? Is that your bill, Bill?
Senator Morrison, yeah.
Okay, Senator.
Bill, Bill, Bill.
Your bill, Bill.
Do we have the A version of that?
It should be in your file if it is.
Yeah, is the A version in the file?
Okay, it's Senator Morissette and Company, and that's good.
No, I probably don't. Oh, goodness gracious. I'm sorry. Let me get this over there.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. And I'd like to say that I'm happy to be here today. I am happy to be here, but in some ways we're dealing with a very tragic situation. And hopefully being here and moving this on can prevent other tragic situations from occurring. So what I'd like to do is just make a few brief remarks, and we have other testimony that will go into greater detail. I did pass out a piece that I put together for my floor remarks, and I would like to point out that we're talking about a helmet bill. We're talking about children up to 16 years of age, covering scooters, skates, skateboards. And the justification for doing this, I think, will become apparent as we go through the testimony. But I would like to say that the state of California passed or enacted the most stringent helmet bill in the country on January 1st of this year. And that covers people up to 18 years of age on those same wheeled instruments of death sometimes or injury. There are several other states that do that, that also have a bill, Maryland, Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey, and because of the many, many, many injuries and the types of injuries, some of them are not apparent, even though you bump your head and have what may appear to be a concussion. Sometimes a concussion is minor and it doesn't affect your ability to function. Other times, what appears to be a mild concussion turns into a traumatic brain injury and does have lasting impacts. And so I think this is a really important bill. And so with that, I will end my testimony and turn it over to Diane Amundson or Sean. Sean, why don't you go ahead and go first, and then Diane.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sean Cleave. I'm here on behalf of Senator Clarno, who is co-sponsor with Senator Morissette of this bill. Senator Clarno introduced this bill on behalf of her grandson, Tyler Henley. They were driving one afternoon down in the Bend area, and they drove by one of the new skate parks, which seemed to pop up on a monthly basis anymore in Oregon. And he brought up the point that one of his good friends had sustained a head injury a few days earlier on the skate park. And she said, was he wearing a helmet? And he said, well, no, he wasn't. And he said, the senator asked her grandson if he wore a helmet, and he said, well, of course, my parents always make me wear a helmet. But the fact remains that many children aren't wearing helmets when they're doing these activities, whether it be inline skating, skateboarding, or riding on the new scooters. And we really feel that the statistics speak for themselves, and I don't think it's very necessary today to go into all the lives that we could potentially save, or at least by death, if not severe injury, by enacting these bills. But I think we'll turn it over to somebody who can speak deeply on the subject, and she can demonstrate why this bill is very important. Thank you for hearing it.
My name is Diane Amundsen, and I live at 1102 South 69th Street, Springfield, Oregon. And I'm here to support the passage of 795 bill by changing the safety behavior of our young riders through legislative action. On July 23, 2001, our 11-year-old son, Tyler Amundsen, was riding his scooter down the hill to a friend's house. He rode into the intersection and crashed into a truck coming through it. The front of Tyler's head took the first hit against the side of the truck. As he then fell back, he struck his head yet again on the hard pavement. The impact of the blow cracked his skull open. As his father and I approached our lifeless son's body lying in the middle of the street, we knew immediately that he was dying. He was taken to Sacred Heart Hospital, where we were told he was going to die any moment. As a last-minute decision to try to save his life, the doctors cut the side of his skull to allow his brain to swell and alleviate the pressure. He was then life-flighted by helicopter to Legacy Emmanuel in Portland, where he was not expected to make it through the night. Tyler was in a coma on life support for 15 days. Minute by minute, he lay barely clinging to life as we watched and prayed helplessly. His two sisters, his dad, and I, we wrapped our arms around him and watched him fade away in his last moments. Our hands felt the very last beat of his heart as we said goodbye to him, and he died of severe head injuries. If there would have been a law in place requiring helmets for other recreational equipment, Tyler would have worn his helmet. I witnessed this event daily with him and his friends. They would automatically put their helmets on when riding their bikes with no arguments or questions asked, yet they would throw off their helmets when switching over to scooters, skateboards, and rollerblades. This routine would take place over and over throughout the day. I believe that because the helmet law was in place for the bikes, this is why they so readily made the switch when transferring to a bike. I've seen kids who do wear their helmets and take them off because of peer pressure from their friends and because of no law that requires them to keep them on. When children are playing, they often are excited and impulsive. They don't take the time to think about their own safety first. It's up to us adults to protect our children, and by making a law, it lends support to many parents who struggle to gain safety compliance from their children. Our son Tyler died. His life alone would have been worth this law, but I know it can save others. When a large number of children are getting hurt, this is our key to stop and take action against the problem. Just think of the lives and injuries we could save our children from. There is a law for children under 16 to wear a helmet when riding bikes. We would like to match this existing law to all recreational equipment such as scooters, skateboards, and rollerblades. Kids are out riding on public streets and sidewalks around a lot of traffic with new technology of faster and more extreme products. Anytime you're moving faster than you can run, it should require the single most effective safety device available to reduce head injury and death. Head injury is the number one killer of children under 15 years of age. All it takes is one accident to take a kid's life or seriously injure them. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention reports that helmets can prevent 60% of head injuries. A helmet around the head is so important. Head injuries are very serious and are such a vital part to us. Many injuries heal. Brain damage can last a lifetime. I can tell you firsthand that Tyler's medical bills for the 15 days of life support came to $500,000. If he would have lived, it would have cost billions of dollars for a lifetime of care. We were fortunate enough to have medical insurance. Not everyone does. Today, Tyler would have been 13 years old and a seventh grader in middle school. I cannot begin to tell you the pain we endure on a daily basis, knowing that his life was taken from him in such a sudden instance. Sharing our story and hope for legislation called Tyler's Law requiring helmets can save another child from permanent injury or death in the future. We don't want parents to go through the deep, painful loss that we've had to experience with losing our precious child. Our hearts have truly been broken. Thank you.
Thank you. I can only imagine how difficult it must have been for you to come here and tell your story today. I appreciate that. Do we have questions?
Mr. Chair, may I add?
You certainly may.
In case you're wondering about the name Tyler, because that is also the name of Senator Clarno's grandson. They are a year apart in age, and it is interesting that they are both named Tyler, and both of them, of course, are affected by this bill, so in different ways. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If I could, I'd like to call Dr. James Lace. Doctor, I understand you have to go soon. And could we also call Bill Olson with Dr. Lace? You're right. Go ahead, please.
Okay, Chairman. I guess standing in, Chairman, Vice Chairman. For the record, my name is Dr. James Lace. I'm a pediatrician. I'm located here in Salem, Oregon. I represent the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Pediatric Society, and the Oregon Safe Kids Coalition. You have my written testimony, and I'll just take a few brief moments of your time. The big thing to remember about head injuries in children is that many of them are devastating, and a lot of them can be prevented with the use of an appropriate helmet. 10 years ago, we passed a bike helmet bill in the state for kids up to the age of 16. At that time, the incidence of kids wearing bike helmets was way less than 5%. We were actually a control group for other states looking to look at how kids used their bike helmets or didn't use them. Since that time, our bike helmet usage is over 50%, and with that you can save children's lives. You can save also the incidence of traumatic brain injuries and other things associated with that. Bike helmets at that time were shown to effectively prevent or at least mitigate up to 85% of the severe brain injuries. We'd like to see the same legislation used to prevent these head injuries among these other devices. The thing to remember about this is that children, by and large, and most parents, by and large, will follow the law. And we're not asking that the police go out and arrest kids or throw them or cite their parents for not having a helmet on. What we are doing is just as you heard, where if kids get the message on the media, through their schools, through other areas, that they're supposed to wear their helmet when they're doing this, by and large, the majority of them will do that. So, in fact, this is an educational bill, and as such, we're not looking for, you know, major enforcement in terms of tickets or anything like this. But to get the message out to everybody, you have to wear a helmet. This is for safety, and it's also the law, and that does work. With that, I'll stop. I brought some Play-Doh, and I wanted to show you, just to give you an idea on bike helmets. I had my own son fall off and do one of those head-over things when he was wearing the bike helmet. I watched him and thinking, oh, my God. The bike helmet saved me. This is just an old battery thing here. But bike helmets are designed to, you know, take a blow. And they are constructed that way. You have to meet certain standards. If you don't have a bike helmet on, your brain, one of those things, you know, your brain, whatever, you take the same thing, fall, same injury, you get this crushing injury to the brain. And the brain is not able to absorb the shock. So the bike helmets do work. They don't look like much when you look at them, but they actually make a huge difference for children and for serious injuries. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Any questions?
I'm sorry.
I have a quick question. Are the helmets, would they be the same?
Yes. They're bike helmet standards. So that's what, and actually they have national standards to look at exactly that very issue. So So that's the kind of helmet. It has to be a bike helmet approved helmet to be used for these kids.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Question.
Will they, like, at the skate parks, would they post it that you can't skate here unless you have a helmet on? Maybe they do that already, but I'm thinking of the one out in my area at Donald. And
they're not. They're not right now. If you go down here to Wilson Park, there's nothing down there right now, but that would be one of the goals here, to say that you have to have that.
Thank you.
Other questions? Doctor, I know you have to be somewhere. If you need to go ahead and leave, you're welcome to. If we'd love to have you stay.
Okay. Thank you.
Please go ahead. And our chairman is here. He'll take over.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I wasn't sure. Way to go. Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Bill Olson. I'm here representing the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. The association's mission is to improve the quality of life for people with brain injury and their families, and to prevent brain injury, which is not an afterthought. It's a very important goal of ours. As a personal note, my son, Michael, did suffer a brain injury from a skiing accident back in 1983. He has no observable physical disability, but he has severe cognitive impairment, which has made it impossible for him to live independently. Having gone through the experience ourselves, we're very committed to trying to spare other parents the experience of brain injury, and speak here today in part also for personal reasons. We support SB 795 for the following reasons. TBI is a devastating injury with severe economic and social consequences, and it is largely preventable. The use of an appropriately designed and fitted helmet when engaged in certain recreational activities has been shown to be highly effective in preventing or mitigating brain injury. Requiring the use of protective headgear by statute adds state authority in support of parents who are urging reluctant youth to use such protective wear. And there is a significant public health benefit to the prevention of brain injuries, since the state and federal government frequently become the funder of last resort when there are long-term economic costs of the injury. I've included some information in my testimony about the scope and significance of brain and the consequences of brain injury. I'm not going to take your time to go through that. Would be happy to respond to questions if there are some. Again, the data I have seen suggests that and bicycle use and inline skating, the use of headgear has been effective in preventing up to 85% of head injuries that otherwise might have occurred. The Bicycle Helmet Safety Institute has a website which discusses helmets, and I would just, in response to the question that was raised earlier about the type of helmet, that particular source, and they are fairly authoritative on helmets, does suggest that for skateboarding, a higher standard helmet be utilized. And I cite the specification in the testimony, but that would be something perhaps to look into in the implementation of the Act or in awareness and publicity. And that simply may be because of the more acrobatic things that are done on a skateboard. I don't really know the reason for that recommendation. In conclusion, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify and present evidence to you, and would be happy to respond to questions if you have them.
Thank you, Bill. Is there any questions? Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, I'm a skier. In fact, I skied with my grandson last Saturday, and I've often wondered. I have some friends that have fallen, and luckily they've only had concussions, and so I sympathize with your son. I'm very aware of it. And I now wear a helmet. I started wearing it 2 years ago. And there are differences in helmets. When I ski, the helmet is all the way down. When I ride my bike, it's a different type of helmet. And I just wondered, was there any discussion in this bill whether or not my friends, what I call the board heads, especially the boarders who ski a lot through trees, and is there any statistics, and why wouldn't they, or will we someday require them to wear helmets also, and skiers,
To be honest with you, I have not seen any statistics on injuries from skiing. They may exist, and I apologize that I don't have them if they do exist, but I have not seen them. My son is able to ski, and believe it or not, he does ski. We let him ski. We don't necessarily encourage it, but we allow him to ski, and he has a helmet to be sure. But I don't know the statistics.
Well, follow up. A lot of this is in the education. My grandson, who I skied with, didn't wear a helmet, but his parents don't. My four children ski, and they don't wear helmets, so I got to get them to wear helmets first, and maybe then my 10 grandkids will start wearing them. So something I got to work on.
It's adults first. That's what I said on the floor the other day.
Yeah. Is there any other questions? And then thank you, Bill. Gene Leon. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning. Honorable Chair and members of the Transportation Committee, my name is Jean Lum, and I work for Springfield Fire and Life Safety in the Emergency Medical Services Division. And I am here and also wanting to thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of SB 795. I have provided written testimony, but I want to give you some of the highlights because I've done a lot of work on research about a few statistics that I feel you will find pretty compelling. According to the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, injuries to children is skyrocketing for all roller sports activities. Unintentional injury is the number one leading cause of death for children 14 and under. The reason I feel we should require children to wear helmets is that 5,686 children 14 and under died in the year 2000 from a rollerblade incident. 120,000 of those were permanently disabled. We are very concerned about the rising brain injuries because cuts and bruises and even broken bones can heal, but unfortunately, damage to the brain does not heal that easily. Even a low-speed fall can change a child's life forever because in an instant, their head can smack the street, the sidewalk, the curb, a car, a tree, and cause head injury. Also, I wanted you to know that young children are particularly vulnerable to head injuries. They have a proportionately larger head and a higher center of gravity, and their coordination isn't quite developed. So it is much more difficult for children to avoid obstacles when participating in these type of roller sports. Our paramedics at Springfield Fire and Life Safety are responding regularly to this concern for children. I wanted you to know also that the specific sports-related injuries from just scooters alone had a 700% increase in 2001 compared to 2000. So as Mrs. Amundsen said, it is suggested that 60% of these injuries could be prevented. And that the use of helmets, we believe, as a department, is the single most effective way to prevent injuries and fatalities. So we feel that, as with safety belts and child car seats, the enactment of laws requiring the use of helmets, along with education, is the most promising way to increase helmet usage. And as a parent, I also speak to the fact that when my son would head off on a bicycle, he'd have his helmet on. When he did other roller sports, I could not convince him that he, with the threat of being grounded, that he had to wear his helmet. We as a Springfield Fire Department are wholeheartedly in favor of what I call a life-saving bill. And I feel it is also the right thing to do for our children. Do you have any questions on statistics or anything that you might like to know today?
Is there any questions? Don't look like it.
Thank you very much.
Lisa Miller, please.
Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Miette, and I'm the manager for Health Services Injury Prevention and Epidemiology Program. A lot of really good points have been made today by people who have testified before me, so I'll only add additional things. I think there are four things that I would say. We're here to testify in support of this bill, and one thing I would say would be to add some information about the data about head injuries while skating, riding scooters, and riding skateboards. The data in 2000 to 2001 are fairly incomplete, and I say that because when children are hospitalized, or when anyone's hospitalized, there's a form that's filled out on the hospitalization. One of the codes that's added to the form is called an external cause of injury code. Right now in Oregon, hospitals are only coding these cases voluntarily at about 60%. So what I know is about 60% of the cases. So 32 children were hospitalized. These are between the ages of 0 and 16, while because of riding on skateboards or riding scooters or skating. Two of these children died in 2000 and 2001. Tyler Amundsen is not the only case in the state of Oregon. That's the point I want to make. 24 of those 32 kids had head injuries serious enough to be hospitalized. The cost of the care for those kids, and 25% of this is borne by the state, is about $442,000. Another additional piece of information that might be of interest is that for every hospitalization, you usually have about 20 cases that are treated in an emergency department, and those are also additional costs that we don't really have a data system to collect. Another important point would be that in communities, we have, in Oregon, we have 15 Safe Kids chapters and two coalitions in the state, and these are very active groups that are interested in looking at unintentional injuries and how to prevent them in their communities. In Oregon, Oregon Safe Kids and the National Safe Kids and the Academy of Pediatrics all support the helmet bills. In fact, one of the things that Oregon Safe Kids do is they distribute really low-cost helmets. And if you go to a store and look at bicycle helmets in a bike shop, they can cost as much as $60 to $80. Those are very expensive. But through the distribution through Oregon Safe Kids, we can distribute helmets at a cost of $5 a piece. So we've got some really effective distribution planned and that we're already working on for distributing helmets to people at very low cost. My final point is that injuries are not accidents, that when we study how injuries happen, we find that they're predictable and preventable, and we'd ask you to support this bill.
Thank you, Lisa. Is there any question? Don't look like there is. That's all. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 795 and open the work session on Senate Bill 795. Representative Byer.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 795 to the floor with a passed recommendation.
Representative Byer moves Senate Bill 795 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Greenlight.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries, and Representative Greenlight will carry the bill for us. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Open the work session on House Bill 2986. And Janet, can you
thank you, Mr.
Get
Chair.
Us up to speed?
House Bill 2986 was the bill that would have deleted a requirement that physicians and healthcare workers report to the Department of Transportation impairments that affect a person's ability to safely drive a vehicle. It would make would have made such reporting discretionary. There was quite a bit of testimony taken on this measure and several alternatives proposed. Representative Greenlick met with some of the parties
in the early part of the week, and we have at your place today the Dash 4 amendments. They maintain the mandatory reporting requirements that are under current law, but extend the immunity from civil liability for providers that do not make a report. Providers under current law already are immune from civil liability if they do make a report. This adds the clause that if they do not make a report also. It maintains provisions of the original bill that specify that the report filed is confidential and may not be admitted as evidence in any civil or criminal action. Representative Greenleaf may have some comments as well.
Representative Greenleaf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You gave me a hard assignment to get all those people together and still get something you could understand.
That is a challenge.
But I think we did it. The current bill, which makes reporting mandatory and for which the rulemaking process has been going on for some time, and a pilot project is about to begin in six counties, is a good bill. I'm talking to all of the participants, which included the OMA, the ophthalmologist, the optometrist, ODOT, and our own colleague, Representative Bates, who had very strong feelings about this, came to what we think is a simple solution for the problem, and it will give us a chance to look at it again in the next session. What this does is it keeps the reporting mandatory. It uses the rulemaking process that was developed for the pilot counties, which will be changed if the experience in the pilot counties determine that. But it adds what the physicians were most worried about, which is, in addition to the exemption from liability for good faith reporting, it also includes an exemption from civil liability for good faith not reporting. The assumption being that the law will be in place, the statute will be in place, and if a physician does not report in good faith, then the professional organizations would be responsible for sanctioning that, the Board of Medical Examiners or the equivalent board of other professionals. Representative Bates felt very strongly about this. He felt that having mandatory reporting keeps the physician protected as well as the patient. He said that allows me, Dr. Bates, as a physician, to say to the patient, well, first of all, I think it's your own safety you shouldn't be driving, but second of all, I have no choice but to report it. It's the law, and I'm going to have to report it. So the only other thing the Dash 4 amendments do is you'll see on line 10 and 11, it was pointed out by ODOT that, as it said, medical information in the reports are confidential. The report itself was not confidential, and this rewording expands that word to keep the report as a confidential document, not only the medical information inside the report. So if a patient asks, if a citizen asks the state who squealed on them, basically the state will have to say the report is confidential and I can't tell you. So I think this is a good solution. All the parties have agreed to it. They're out there watching like a hawk and nodding yes, and including ODOT, who feels comfortable with this after conferring with their attorneys. And I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2986.
Representative Greenleaf moves the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2986. Is there any discussion?
Chair.
Representative Zahner.
Good work, Representative.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your efforts. You did a great job.
I would second that. No discussion? Is there any objection? Amendments are adopted.
I move House Bill 2986 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Greenleaf moves House Bill 2986 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Breyer.
Thank you. As I was listening to the explanation, I think I just wanted to clarify in my mind for sure that the legislative intent of this is that these reports are mandatory.
Yeah, that is the original statute, and this does nothing to change that in any way. The only thing that implies different is the original description, and I think the original. And this takes out all the deletes and everything from the original.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ryan, any more discussion? Seeing none, Ryan, you want to call the roll?
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlight.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
I would be happy to carry this one, too.
Okay. Representative Greenluck will carry this.
In the sun.
2886.
All these health things.
Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 425. Janet, can you get us up to speed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Senate Bill 425A is a bill that was worked out extensively with a work group, as I understand, out of the Senate committee, and it would allow truckers and transporters to request a road authority to allow unrestricted access on specific routes for truck tractors and semi-trailer combinations that are in excess of lengths that are authorized by statute. Upon request, it would require the road authority to do an evaluation, a test run with the type driving behind the type of vehicle that is for which the request is reported, to see if the truck length can safely travel the route. Mr. Chair, there's interested parties are here to testify, and that's my comments. There is a minimal fiscal impact, and so you don't need to have a fiscal impact statement. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think this says Bob Russell.
You can't just sit back there and smirk, huh?
Well, he's got to bring some help.
Yes, that'd be fine. Everybody.
Members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. We're very pleased with this bill, and as Janet mentioned, it's the product of a work group over on the Senate side. And what this is all about is farm-to-market transportation. There are instances where today we can't get the trucks that are required by a farmer to a farmer's farm. And this gives us a process so that we can evaluate the road and the route to make sure that we can do so safely. It sets up the criteria. It's a very positive step forward, we believe, for farm-to-market transportation, and we support the bill.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Representative Brown, my name is Mark Simmons. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurserymen today. And this is a very good bill. We were pleased to see it introduced in the Senate. It was a work group that met a number of times to work out details and issues between county road authorities and concerns that growers had and truckers had was facilitated by Mr. Greg Del Ponte over in the Department of Transportation, and we're here to support the bill, and we'd very much like to see it passed into law.
Thank you, Mark. Sean?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, representing the Pacific Northwest Christmas Tree Association. We also support Senate Bill 425. We've been working on these farm-to-market access issues, I know, from an association since 99, and this bill, we think, is a huge positive step to what Bob mentioned, farm-to-market access. In the Christmas tree industry, our processing time to get the trees to the stores and areas that you buy Christmas trees is about a 20-day window. And so from that respect, we are running trucks in and out of the farm 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 20 days to get that done. And so any restriction or any kind of hang up in getting the truck to where the trees will be loaded and shipped out of here any hang-up slows down the farm-to-market access and creates a real problem, especially in the Christmas tree industry. So this bill allows us to work with the counties, the road authorities, for that unauthorizing the unrestricted access, making sure that it is safe, identifying the place where at the farm where they're going to pick it up, and so the county and the knows that that is the correct route that the trucks will travel. And if the trucks travel off that route, then obviously that is they're on their own at that point and will be ticketed. But how it's our responsibility as farmers to request that and to make sure that that route is available, and we work with the state and the counties, and I know everybody's comfortable with the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sean. Any questions? Representative Greenlight.
Yes, hi, I have a couple. Thank you for coming today. This doesn't do anything to increase the length of trucks that are on the freeways or other kinds of things, is that,
Mr.
Is that right?
Chairman, Representative Greenlight, no, not at all. We've had a freeze on truck size and weights that was imposed by Congress in 1991, and that freeze remains in place. All this does is provide an evaluation tool to allow those trucks that are operating on state highways today access to county roads if they can do so safely.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
I'm looking at on page 3, I don't know if you have the bill, that the amendments to the permitting process and is there anything intended on line 31 by changing? I'm trying to learn. Part of my rookie experience here is to learn when the shalls and the mays and the musts. And I think I've got it for the positives, but now when I get the shalls and the mays and the must nots, it gets a little harder. Is that just a wording issue?
Mr. Chairman,
the OLC is doing a lot of wording stuff.
Yes, it is a wording issue, and it really reflects what's going on here. You've got multiple levels of evaluation that happens, and that's why we've changed that particular shell to a may, because there's an additional evaluation criteria that is not in statute today, where someone could, in fact, issue a permit if they can do so safely.
But if I may follow up just briefly on this, but may not means can't, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this isn't may, this is may not.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlight, I think it means the same thing. I think Legislative Council has been actually changing these on their own.
Okay.
And so this wasn't something that the group came up with. It's my understanding that Legislative Council has been, as we amend these statutes, they've been changing it on their own to mean the same thing.
That's what it seems to me, too.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Representative Greenlight.
Thank you. This is for whoever wants to answer the question, but actually I'm in the same spot on page 3, just the following line, 32, about the permit is not valid for longer than a year. So I'm assuming the issue is still going to stand. So does that mean you have to go back and reapply on an annual basis and we'll have to redo an evaluation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkra, if I can answer that question, yes. And actually, but once the roads are actually determined, it's just actually going through the process and getting that permit. In the Christmas tree industry, we actually buy a seasonal permit. We don't buy you can buy an annual permit, but most of the time it's a seasonal. In Clackamas County, it's called the STOP program. And they go and they, once that road is determined, now the farmer might change, though, where they're going to pick up. You know, they might have a pickup in one field and the next year decide we're going to do it in this field. They're going to have to go back to the county and make sure that those roads are safe and that the county understands that those roads, where they're going to pick up, and do that the next year. And so it is the farmer's responsibility to still stay on top and communicate with the county and not assume that, and so we're actually fine with doing that on an annual basis or a minimum an annual basis.
I have one follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That helps clarify. Regarding the cost of the permit, I'm assuming there's a fee associated. Does that cover the cost of the analysis that the county road crews planners have to do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelter, there's a provision where the counties can charge the requester for the evaluation. The permits themselves cost $8 or less. Most of them cost $8 per year. So if the permit fee does not cover the cost of the evaluation. But at the county's option, they can charge the requester of the evaluation for the cost of providing that service.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, if I can follow up on that, it is in the farmer's best interest to, if we're going to pay for that, it is worth us paying for that, because if we can't get that truck there to where we're picking, the pickup site, we can't get any of the product to market. So it's in our best interest to pay for that.
Thank you.
Any other question? Thank you.
Chair.
Morning, John.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, John O'Shell, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. We are supporting this bill. It has been a very interesting process to get where we are. We started off thinking first we were dealing with an issue with nurserymen, and it expanded into other areas, which frankly we think is very appropriate that we try and resolve some problems. Backing up a bit, there has always been a great deal of difficulty getting a consistent set of permitting processes and regulations in the county. And to give you a sense of the major issue on the problem has to do with, frankly, engineers, road officials talk one language when we're talking in trucks, and the motor carriers and truckers talk a totally different language. The classic would be when you look at how bridges are designed. The engineers have a set of jargon, HS, and a whole series of ways we identify truck configurations. When you go over on the motor carriers, they've got a whole bunch of different configurations. Not only do we call them different things, they don't match. And so when we try and get something consistent, we just constantly have a terrible time doing it. As a part of the work session, work group that came out of this bill on the Senate side, basically three things came out of it. One was basically a better understanding of the STOP program that is going on in McClackamas County, which basically changes where instead of the county issuing a permit to each trucker, the county works directly with the farmer to develop a route and conditions, and then the farmer issues the permits. Counties looked at that and said, hey, that's slick. And so basically that's not even in the bill. We said, let's just get the word out to the counties, and we think most of the counties are just going to jump on that idea. So that's one good thing came out of this work group. The second two, one was the thing that says, all right, since everything seems to be apples and oranges, if we've got a route here that is probably okay, let's set up an agreement that says, hey, truck will provide a truck, we'll provide a guy, we'll go out and drive it, and we don't have to worry about what it's called. It's a truck, it's so long, it worked. And we can say, good. Now, it's a process to do it. The question on fees, it's set up so that we can. The anticipation is probably most agencies won't. Two reasons. One, we like to get the trucks going up and down the road and pulling the commerce out of the county, too. And two, we don't think it's going to happen too often. Most of the routes are still probably going to require permits. But it does set a process where we have certain ones that are routes regularly used. We can clean up a system so those trucks don't have to go through so much permitting process as they go to use the route. The third thing they did, and it's right at the bottom of the bill, it talks about setting up a set of consistent rules. Now, there's a couple mays and shalls in there. What it says is ODOT will go through the process. They may establish rules. If they choose to establish rules, then the counties shall abide by them. A little bit different configuration than we've often worked with before, but we had testimony by Greg Del Ponte, who's probably the one going to be handed the task of coming up with these rules, that says his intention is if we can get consensus, he'll adopt. If he can't get consensus, he probably won't. And the counties are willing to take Greg Del Ponte's word on that. Greg's a good person to work with, and he's worked good with coalitions, and he got us through a lot of the stuff that we have in this bill. So it is our intention to try and get us all talking the same language as far as the process to get a permit at least, and then to identify clearly where it is the places that the counties do in fact need to make different decisions, because conditions certainly are different from county to county. In conclusion, we support what is in this bill. We support this as a first step on a process to try and get the permitting processes to work better.
Thank you, John. One of the questions I had was regarding the fiscal impact, which is, looks like to be very small, and I think you've answered most of my questions.
We do not anticipate a large fiscal impact. If the issue of doing those analyses turns into something major, we have the ability to charge for the service.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 425? Nobody. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 425 and open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
I move Senate Bill 425A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder moves Senate Bill 425 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Ryan, will you call the roll?
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair. We put this on the consent calendar.
Representative Zahner moves that we place this on the consent calendar. Is there any objection?
Yes.
Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar.
Save time.
How treatable I am.
I want to hear green like again.
Thank you for saving us.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 181A. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 181A makes a mind-numbing number of modifications to Department of Transportation standards for vehicles in the Motor Vehicle Code. The standards deal with such things as equipment, lighting, mud flaps. There are a number of wording changes in the bill to make it consistent with who the current federal agencies are that set standards. And it makes it clear that ODOT's authority to consider and adopt subsequent federal standards is subject to appeal. What a lot of the wording changes also take out ODOT's authority to test equipment themselves, which they are not doing, and so that it's a unnecessary language in the current statute. The Senate bill did have a provision, original Senate bill, a provision to about display of electronic devices, and that was taken out, so that it no longer deals with that issue. This bill no longer deals with that issue. Mr. Chair, there are A4 amendments at your place. They make some technical changes, again, to naming what these federal agencies are named, and the very last section of the bill deals with not allowing lights to be covered, having coverings over lights, and the amendment, the last two lines of the amendment make it clear that that's only when they're in operation. The covers could be on when you're not required to use the lights, but have to be taken off when you are using the lights or are required to use the lights. Mr. Chair, Stan Porter's here from the Department of Transportation.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Janet a question?
Certainly.
The business about the unlawful viewing of a display screen, the amendments take it out of the proposal, but not out of statute. Is that right? The original,
no.
The original bill would have created that offense. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 181, the original bill, would have prohibited viewing
a display. A new offense.
It would have created a new offense. This does not create a new offense.
Thank you, Janet. Stan? We expect you to go through a mind-numbing bill again, word by word now.
Word by word in 3 minutes.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, essentially this is a housekeeping bill trying to update our standards to the standards that are the federal government. Essentially what happened was when the statutes were written for Oregon, they mirrored the federal statutes. And what actually is required by the current statute is that Oregon do the same exact job as the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration of the U.S. Department of Transportation. And in the second paragraph of the under the purpose, you'll see that currently we're supposed to be requiring manufacturers of automobiles, child safety seats, to give us their documentation on how they manufactured their safety belts and their anchorages and their child safety seats. We're supposed to test those items, approve them, send them approval letters, and then also police that industry by going out and making sure that everything that's for sale is what they say it is, and pulling it off the shelf that it isn't, and all that kind of thing. And that's the federal government's job, not ours, but that's what our statutes currently say. And so this bill, and in many other places in the statutes, it also says that for other types of equipment, lighting equipment and brakes and all this kind of thing. So what we're trying to do is just clean the language up so that we're not the policing authority for those, that it stays with the federal government. There are a couple of modifications in there that are intended to improve the law on section. There's a section by section that's included with my testimony. On section 13, there's a modification from the type 3 fender or mudguard height from 20 inches to 27 inches, and that just allows the person that goes down and buys a new Dodge pickup to be a lawful owner of that Dodge pickup instead of a fender as soon as he drives it off the lot from the Dodge dealership, because they're that high nowadays. And that was originally designed for commercial vehicles way back when it was first written. On Section 20, there's a new portion there that allows headlight flashers on emergency vehicles that are already presently using them. So we ought to make the law allow them to use that. On Section 24, there's a new stipulation in there that allows flashing brake lights on a motorcycle as long as it doesn't override the turn signal function of that motorcycle, and that was asked for by the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety as well as Oregon State Police. And in one other section, in Section 31, Janet already told you about the light covers. That just puts it in one place in the law, so in the vehicle statute, so you don't have to look in five other locations to find that same thing. So what we're trying to do is just make our laws mesh with the federal government's laws, taking us out of their role, putting us in the correct role, and then cleaning up some of the language. I don't know why, but in some portions of the language, they had language that was not inconsistent with, which means consistent. And the title of the bill says consistent, but down in the body it says not inconsistent. So we tried to clean up some of that stuff also. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chairman. Any questions? Representative's honor.
Do they want the dash ones in here? Or is it, do we have to screw those? In the
have to those. I believe that...
I'm sorry. A4s?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Those don't, Chair and Representative or Senator Zonda, they don't, they just clarify things and make it easier for everyone to understand. And Chair and members of the committee, we also worked with the SEMA, which is an aftermarket group that sells all this aftermarket lighting equipment and things. We worked with them, and we worked with some other aftermarket people on this, and they are agreeable to the amendments that were made.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify on Senate Bill 181? I would entertain a motion to. I see we're in. We'll close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 181.
Dash four amendments to Senate Bill 181.
Representative Zonner moves the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 181. Is there any objection? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 181 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Zonner moves Senate Bill 181 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I need to call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carried.
Mr. Chair, unless someone wants to carry it, I would love to move this on the consent calendar.
Representative Zahner moves that the House Senate Bill 181 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so done. We are waiting on LC 3582, which will arrive at any moment. And so we're going to stand in recess to 10:45.
We'll sit in recess.
We on the air? Okay, and we introduce...
Well, they're all at the funeral, all the wives. I'm finishing this joke. You ready?
I'm ready for you to introduce LC 3582 as a committee bill.
So ordered. I would like to order a salami. No. What do you need? What's the right
word?
We
need to motion to adopt LC 3582 as a committee bill.
I move to make a motion that we adopt that LC.
Representative Donner, as a Donner moves that we adopt LC 3582 as a committee bill. And Janet, explain to us what happened.
The words right.
Mr.
On.
Chair, this was an abandoned boat removal bill. We already had a hearing on it. It's 2685, House Bill 3685. It now had to be redrafted because the relating clause didn't fit the bill or the amendments that were needed. So this is a new bill with a relating clause that's broader.
Gotcha.
And that's why we're doing this. We needed it to do it today because we're not meeting Friday and we want to work it next week.
So. The legal counsel office had admitted an error in drafting, and so we got a second chance.
Right. And this has been approved by the Speaker. That's the route now, yeah. Of course, for getting anything introduced. So.
Is there any objection? Hearing none? To order.
So the three lines are together.
And we are recessed. Or not recessed, we're adjourned.